Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome. There's still more seats if you're coming in. Please grab one. I want to welcome everyone. My name is Ethan Tucker, and I am here on the faculty of Mechon Hadar. And it is really a privilege to welcome everyone to this space of learning and this sort of mini community of learning and conversation that we create here for a day. And before we kind of jump into the content, I just want to really make everyone conscious of the incredible range of people who are in this room. I want to begin by, first of all, thanking in advance my colleagues on the faculty who are going to be aiming to put together a terrific day of learning for all of you today. And also acknowledge members of the board of Mechon Hadar who are here. Our board chair, John Lopatin, Debbie Bonin, Vicki Abrams, Dan Perla, David Gilbert. If there's other folks who have walked in, then you should also make yourselves known. But I think those are the folks here at the moment. It is really due to the guidance and leadership of the board that this organization has able to come from a twinkle in various people's eyes to something that really is a full-blown institution able to host a day of learning of this sort. As far as those of us who are here for the day, I want to welcome really three sets of people. First, welcome once again, as we have for every day in these past few weeks, the full-time students who are here this summer, who anchor this Beit Midrash for the broader community for 8 weeks during the summer, coming from campuses, cities, all over the country, all kinds of different religious backgrounds, but building together a shared community of religious purpose, practice, and a search for meaning. So welcome, as always, to you. Welcome again for the third and a half day to our executive seminar participants who also come from all over the country who are here for an immersive week of learning. We've been putting all of you through the ringer in terms of long days, early mornings, late nights, and really the energy that you've been bringing to the Beit Midrash is terrific. And then last but definitely not least, those of you who are here today for the Yom Iyun. And joining in to create the hum in this Beit Midrash today. And I really want to welcome you both. If you've come back, we're glad you enjoyed your first time of learning with us. And if it is your first time being here, we hope that this will not be the last, and it'll really be an introduction into a conversation of Torah that we hope can be really an ongoing, meaningful part of your Jewish life. Today's theme is boundaries, Jews and the other. And I want to begin with just a couple framing comments to give us a sense of the day and some of what maybe you should think about over the course of the day to frame the many, many sources and many perspectives that we'll learn. It's often the case that outsiders tell us more about ourselves than we are really aware of. And I want to begin with the two comments of two outsiders in Tanakh, in the Bible, Bilam and Haman, and what they have to say about the Jewish people. The first thing that Bilam, the non-Jewish prophet hired by Balak, the king of Moab, says when he opens his mouth after looking at the Jewish people is, "Ki meirosh tzurim erenu umigvaot ashurenu, hen am levadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yitchashav." I look at this people from the heights, I gaze down upon them from the hills. They are a people who dwells alone. They are not reckoned among the nations. First thing that Bilam notices before talking about any quality about the Jewish people, the Israelite nation, is that they are somehow different from everyone else, and the terms of measurement used to assess the other peoples of the world will not somehow fit or apply to them. And Haman, the arch-villain of Megillat Esther, of the Purim story, the first words out of his mouth to the king Achashverosh are, "Yeshno am echad mifuzar u'miforad bein ha'amim bechol medinot malchutecha v'datehem shonot mikol am." There is a people who, though scattered, is nonetheless different from all the other peoples in your empire, and their practices are different from everyone else's. In other words, in two totally different places and times, two totally different personalities, outsiders look at the Jewish people and say, wow, these people are different in a really meaningful way. The sort of flip observation of that was the quip attributed to Mark Twain many years later: the Jews are like everyone else, only more so. The idea that even when we are alike and we are compared to others, there's something of distinction and difference that seems to run through the essence of what it is to be Jewish in all these different times and places. What we're going to ask you to reflect on today is, what is that difference? And how do we measure and understand it? Is that difference essential? Is there something actually, in a fundamental way, that is different about Jews in their body, in their genes, in their makeup? Is it based in behavior, commitments, beliefs? Is that difference malleable, or is that difference permanent and irrevocable? And we're going to, over the course of the day, focus on these questions from different perspectives. In a moment, we'll begin with a session led by Rabbi Shai Held, which will think about whether the differences between Jews and Gentiles should be considered as more a difference in hardware or a difference in software. Is there something essentially different, or is there a kind of malleable sense to the Jewish-Gentile divide? Then we'll have a break for lunch after the conclusion of the morning, and then breakout sessions in parallel where other of my colleagues will take us through other aspects of this question. Avital Hochstein will explore the question of the study of Torah. Is the study of Torah kind of a thing that Jews do but ultimately can and should be shared with anyone? Or is the study of Torah in a way something that's covenantal and distinctive to Jews and can't, maybe even shouldn't, be fully experienced by anyone outside of that covenantal space? Dina Weiss will be teaching on the role of Shabbat. How does Shabbat play into a concept of Jewish-Gentile difference? Should Shabbat be thought of as the Jews' gift to the world, an invitation to everyone to actually adopt Jewish practices once every 7 days? Or is Shabbat, again, playing out a core covenantal difference that can't actually cross that divide? And then as a third option during that time, Rabbi Eli Kanfer will be exploring, what do we mean when we use in our own internal devotional language the language of difference? In Havdalah every week, where we talk about Ben Yisrael La'amim, that God makes Israel different from the nations, what do we mean and what other ideas does that link us to? And then finally, after we have a break and mincha in the later afternoon, we'll come up here again for a closing session altogether, which I will be leading, on the question of whether one can unbecome a Jew. We're all familiar with the process of what it means to convert into Judaism. How essential is Judaism such that perhaps it's impossible to ever lose that identity? Or how malleable is it such that we could actually imagine certain circumstances in which someone, now a Jew, tomorrow potentially no longer bears that title? So I encourage you to find the links and connections between all the things that we study. I hope you'll enjoy the different presenters here today, and really want to emphasize, which everyone will who's teaching here, that this is not intended just to be sort of 7 hours of us lecturing at you, but really intended to be learning that sparks a conversation. So shoot up your hands, raise your voices, object, contribute, and we'll look forward to a great day of learning together. I turn it over to Shai.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'll just quickly reiterate Ethan's welcome. It is really, it never gets old to say that it is really a privilege and an honor for us to have all of you here. And we hope that this space, whether it already is or whether it has potential to become one of your Jewish homes and one of the centers of Jewish conversation in your life and your world. I want to try this morning to try and explore a series of very basic and yet very difficult questions. First, what is it that distinguishes Jews from Gentiles? And there is another question entwined with that one, or at very least parallel to it, which is, what is it that distinguishes the land of Israel from other places? Now, that may not sound totally intuitive, but in the history of Jewish thought, usually those questions are totally entwined. And those questions are manifestations of something I want to come back to at the end, They are manifestations of a conversation about whether anything in the world is intrinsically holy, or whether holiness means something else. And we'll try to unpack what that something else might mean as we go. So first, what distinguishes Jews from Gentiles? What distinguishes the land of Israel from other places? And then crucially, what might actually be at stake in our answers to that question? Is that merely, and I hate the word merely in this sentence because it would expose my life as a sham, is it merely a philosophical interest, right? Or does it have ethical consequences, actively sort of theological consequences in the way we pray? Does it have interpersonal consequences in the way we relate to people? Does it have a question that becomes alive again in the second half of the 20th century? Does it have political consequences? And if so, what are they? So we're asking sort of both abstract philosophical questions and keeping an eye on their potentially very concrete ramifications in the real world. What I'd like to try and do as a way of thinking about these questions is to really trace two threads in the history of Jewish thought, which we will call in a kind of shorthand the Rambam strand, the Maimonides strand, and the Yehuda Halevi strand, although we're going to complicate each of those pictures. And along the way, I hope we'll learn some interesting things about how Jews have thought about and might continue to think about what it means to talk about the category of the holy, a category that many of us use. And if you think about words that you sometimes have a moment of panic, what if someone asks me to define what I mean when I say that? Holiness is a good one, right? Or the sacred. It's like, I sort of know, it's a little bit like pornography, like a hot deal, right? I sort of know it when I see it, but if you ask me to offer a definition, it would be extremely hard. So I want to sort of try to think about some of that, the holiness part, that is. And I hope, as part of that, also to learn something about two of the giant figures of the Middle Ages, the Rambam, Maimonides, on the one hand, Yehuda Halevi on the other, and actually think about the enormous chasm that divides the way they understand what it means to be Jewish and think about Judaism, right? I think chasm is the right word, and I think we'll get a glimpse of that as we go. So now, to sort of proceed to the task, if you open your source packets to the first page of my session, Dean, is there a page number there? Oh, you don't have it in front of you. Page one, amazing. Don't you hate books that begin on page 9? You feel like they ripped you off, right? So if you look at page 1 of the packet, there are four questions there. Is Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, holy? And if so, in what ways? Is Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, holy? And if so, in what ways? And then, is believing in the holiness of the Jewish people necessary for Jewish theology? Dangerous for Jewish theology? Or, maybe most interestingly, both. And is believing in, affirming the holiness of the land of Israel necessary for Jewish theology, dangerous for Jewish theology, or again, potentially, both? What I'd like to do for the first 5 minutes is ask you to turn to someone next to you and take up the first question. Or actually, let's say it this way, the first and the third. That is, what does it mean to you to say either the Jewish people are in some way holy, or potentially, some of you might say, to refuse to say that, and what is at stake in that conversation? I recognize this is a somewhat abstract question, but I want to sort of just try to get us all into kind of a more active mode of learning. Let's talk about it, then we'll come back and share some thoughts, and then we're going to work through texts and see how the Rambam and Halevi might complicate our lives a little bit. Okay? So we'll take, what did I say, 3 minutes? 5 minutes. Let's take 5 minutes. Okay.
Let's come back together.
It's like being a counselor in camp again. Okay. I'm glad everyone now has a fully worked out theory of holiness. Let's just begin. I want to open the floor for just a short handful of comments. What did you talk about? What was argued? Anything you want to share about what it means to talk about the Jewish people as holy or not to talk about us that way? A few comments, please. Great. Really interesting question. Did people hear that? The question was, what is the relationship between holiness on the one hand and being created in God's image on the other? Can one be created in God's image and not be holy simultaneously? A really interesting question. I think Yehuda Halevi would have extremely interesting things to say about that. Well, maybe we'll get a chance to come back to that. Great. Thank you. Other people, please.
Yeah. I'm very uncomfortable with the concept that holiness is transmitted genetically. Simply by an accident of birth, you become holy. I find that very uncomfortable.
Okay, at the risk of forcing you to say the obvious, you find it uncomfortable because?
Because it implies you're holy without having to do anything. That you simply, by mere existence, no matter what type of life you lead, no matter what your moral character is, you're holy.
Okay, great. Interesting. So that I'm glad I asked that because that's not what I was expecting you to say. You were sort of introducing the centrality of will and effort. I thought you were going to say you were nervous that it might veer off into racism.
Right?
So it's interesting. Those are two possible critiques one might offer, or two might challenges one might put on the table. At least one person agreed with that. Probably more. Two people. No, but I want to. But also, by the way, I want to be careful about not too quickly sort of applying sort of labels, retrojecting them back thousands of years, right? I actually, for whatever it's worth, maybe this is cultural relativism, maybe it's actually being historically aware, I might describe some idea from the 12th century differently when stated in the 12th century and when stated in the 21st. Maybe we'll have a chance to come back to that. Yeah.
Can you speak up a little bit?
With only moderate success, it sounds like, yeah, right? So you're already constructing like a whole sort of like, almost like a metaphysics of holiness, what it means, what it says about other people, which is great. I'm still in simple-minded mode. I want to rev up there. I want to go to get there. Let's take one final comment, please. Okay, so it's very interesting. This is what happens when you ask a sort of very open-ended question. Understandably, people, sort of walked in sort of very different directions. What you're already doing, which is interesting, is kind of beginning to offer what I might call a 21st century theology of pluralism, right? There's a whole multiplicity of paths, all of which are tapping into some notion of the sacred. We could, in another day of learning, tap into or talk about what are the sort of appeals of that way of thinking about it and what are the limits of that way of thinking about it. There's a lot to say about that. You know, theological conservatives like to talk only about the limits of talking like that. Theological liberals like to talk only about the gains of talking like that. I think it's helpful to think about both of those things at the same time. But I want to just maybe mention again, as a response to your comment, you, if I understood your comment correctly, you were really talking about what a sense of the holy means. And maybe implicit in your comment is a sort of unwillingness or a hesitation to fully engage the question of, is there anything that is intrinsically holy? As opposed to everything having a sense of something else that is holy. Right? Those are very different ways of invoking the language of holiness. Right? Holiness mean I walk around and I have a sense that something beyond me is sacred? Or could holiness potentially mean a human being whom I meet is a holy person? Is that language that makes sort of, you know, Jews on the Upper West Side in 2013 feel like, wow, I like that language very much, right? And the only people I would ever call holy are Buddhist monks, because I don't really know a lot about that. Right? No, right, because there's something about that. Something that makes us very, very nervous. And so I appreciate that. I want to sort of see if we can draw some of that out. I think your comment really could be its own Yom Yun in a really, like, interesting way. Okay, so let's shift gears. I know there's much more to say about all this, obviously. I want to sort of shift us into the Middle Ages. Into one of the core dichotomies, the core distinctions between the worldview of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, author of the Kuzari, on the one hand, and Maimonides, author of the Guide of the Perplexed, on the other. And the way this day was titled to sort of, you know, sorry, the way this session was titled to sort of give away where I want to go before we go there is a distinction developed by Professor Menachem Kellner of the University of Haifa, between thinking about difference as a matter of hardware and thinking about difference as a matter of software. That is another way of saying, a kind of contemporary idiom for saying, is there something about the us group, is there something about the Jews, about something that is constitutive in their very being, what you spoke about making you uncomfortable, is there something that is constitutive in their very being that you would describe as, at very least, other and as potentially holy? Or is it, in fact, software? That is, there's no distinction between Jews and Gentiles other than the religious culture they imbibe. Now, I want to sort of stipulate so that we're all on the same page. I'm guessing that if I did a straw poll now, just based on that sentence, 99% of people in the room would say, I like number two, number one makes me a little queasy. I understand that, but what I want to try to do first, as always, is to sort of understand what these two strands have invested in them, why they say what they say, and what the appeal of that view might be. Okay? I'm not doing this in the interest of apologetics for one of you or another. I just want to understand them first. Okay? Yes, please.
Yeah, so I just want to be clear that you're distinguishing between Jews and Judaism. Yeah.
Tell me what you mean by that question.
It makes me a little queasy when you say Jews for the first one, but less queasy when you say Judaism.
Yes, I understand that. That is that reveals our kind of 21st century location. Because talking about sort of an intrinsic difference makes us immediately think, oh my God, wait, this is racism. This isn't racism, right? So it makes a difference. Whereas Judaism, although honestly many American Jews, right, if you were to say something like Judaism is truly distinct from the other religions, maybe even it's truer in some way, most American Jews would begin to, right, run to the hills.
Right, but I'm
right?
Okay with that.
Great. Right, so you're okay. So you're like a semi Upper West Sider. No. But let me sort of say I was very consciously talking about Jews rather than Judaism because for Yehuda Levi, it's very importantly we're talking about Jews because let me leave it at that and then because we're going to go right there now rather than my saying it first. Let's see it inside. So Yehuda Halevi again is the great advocate of the hardware view and. Here's where I think it actually derives from, and this is why these questions are intrinsically tied up with all kinds of interesting philosophical and theological questions. Yehuda Halevi thinks that human beings left to their own devices could never discover the God who we learn about in Revelation. Right? If you allow a philosopher to think, a philosopher might get to the point of talking about a first cause, a God who created the world. But a God who loves Israel, loves humanity, cares about what unfolds in history, no philosopher left to her own devices could get there. Right? For that you need revelation. That's, by the way, a debate that goes on straight into the 20th century. Right? And yet, Yehuda Halevi insists, that's the Jewish God. Right? The Jewish God is the God of the Exodus, the God of Yetziat Mitzrayim. It is the God who appears in history. It is the God who cares about the way the world unfolds. For that, you need God to tell you about God's self. So one of the things that he's interested in is a question of, crucially, how does God make God's self known to humanity? And for that, he thinks, this is admittedly something of a leap, either that or I don't fully yet understand Yehuda Halevi, they're both possible at this moment, that God has to endow certain people with the capacity to receive that conversation from God. In order to make God's self known, God has to prepare a certain community to be able to hear divine revelation. Now, you might say as a criticism, well, you know, why can't we just be born with the capacity for receiving revelation, right? But the sort of the particularity here is that there is a divine, how to translate this term, either from medieval Arabic or from medieval Hebrew, is extremely difficult. We call in medieval Hebrew, Ainyan HaElohi, the divine. Raise, you want to try something?
Thing.
The divine thing, great. Some kind of divine connection, divine substance, but it's not a substance in a material sense, right? If you're interested in a career in medieval Jewish philosophy, you could just spend your life trying to translate Hayyana Elohi, what he means by that exactly. It's mysterious. But there is some capacity for connection with God that is given as a gift to some subsection of the human race. That is what Jews, Yehuda Halevi argues, and Jews alone have. Now, before we immediately start sort of panicking about this, I want to make a few comments about what he's not saying. Nowhere does Yehuda Halevi say that Jews are in any way morally superior to non-Jews. Nor does he say that Jews are intellectually superior to non-Jews. Nor does he say that Jews have unique capacities for statecraft, economic gifts, or any other sort of worldly skill. None of that. They have only one distinction. Now, this, of course, is an only you can put in quotation marks. Because it is, on the one hand, an only one thing. But the only thing for Yehuda Halevi is, in some sense, everything. Right? The only distinction that Jews and non-Jews have is this Inyan Elohi, this capacity for connection with God, this divine substance. Again, I don't really know how to translate it. But, you know, I always tell students that there are certain things I can say I don't know how to translate it, and certain things I can take comfort in saying we don't know how to translate it. This is a we don't know how to translate it. Okay? There's something mysterious. And if you look at the first couple sources, just very quickly, probably the two most famous sentences in the Kuzari, I'll read them in English for now for this purpose. This is the true greatness which descended directly from Adam. This is about being descended from Aver, who is considered the bearer of the line of this divine capacity. He was the noblest creature on earth. Therefore, now speaking to the rabbi, you rank above all the other inhabitants of the earth. Right? Itchayva lachem agdula al kol hanimtzaim ba'aretz. And then, most famously, the sons of Jacob were distinguished from other people by godly qualities, which made them, so to speak, an angelic caste. Sorry. In medieval Hebrew, melachuti, which in modern Hebrew means artificial, right? But melachuti from the word malach, made them angelic. Mevakshim kulam ma'alat hanivu'ah, they all seek prophecy, and the majority of them, that is in the ancient world, Jacob's children, achieve it. Yehuda Halevi decidedly does not think that's true about later Jews, right? But in the early days, in sort of biblical times, right, they all sought prophecy, and the majority of them achieved it. And those who didn't achieve it managed to be close to it by doing sacred acts, connecting with the laws of purity, and being near prophets. So what Jews can do, according to Yehuda Halevi, that non-Jews cannot do, and it is the only thing, right, which again may be everything, is receive prophecy. That is the meaning of Jewish difference. Okay? The meaning of Jewish difference is that Jews, and Jews alone, can receive prophecy. Now this is not a 21st century theology of religious pluralism, right? Because Muslims, presumably, can't actually receive prophecy, Christians can't receive prophecy. Only Jews can receive prophecy. So I'm going to call this, at the risk of making us dizzy, because you'll see why I'm doing this in a minute, I'm going to call this the soft hardware approach. Right? meaning this is, there's a distinction between Jews and Gentiles, but it's actually quite limited. Okay? And it's to receive the capacity of prophecy. John, yeah, please. Yes. So what Yehuda HaLevi is effectively saying, just okay, for those who want to sort of minimize what you may find disturbing, I guess you could say what Yehuda HaLevi is saying effectively is there was a time when prophecy was afoot in the world and only the Jews could have it. Bizman Hazeh, right? In our time, concretely, in terms of divine conversation with us, there is no distinction except that because the laws we observe were revealed by God and the laws other people observe were not, we are tied into the holy in some way no one else is. So there is still a distinction, but it's in a way it's vestigial from the moment when the distinction was live, right? Where some people could receive prophecy in a time when prophecy was afoot and other people could not receive prophecy because they simply weren't wired for it. And that again comes to your challenge in a way, right? They're not wired for prophecy. I want to take two comments here. There's a lot of things to say. Yeah, please, left. Just do it for you, speak up again, because I think hearing is hard.
How would Rabbi Yehuda maybe deal with Bilam?
So the way that many medieval philosophers, by the way, you know, it's a great topic. This book remains to be written about medieval philosophical theories of prophecy as reflected in wrestling with Bilam. At one point when I was actually working on a degree in medieval philosophy, God help me, I actually started to write about this, right? This is something I was working on, the question of like, because all these people who believe that prophecy was exclusive to Jews, how do you understand the moments when prophecy seems to be not exclusive to Jews? I don't actually remember exactly the moment of what he says in the Kuzari about this. I have a feeling, if I'm remembering correctly, it has to do with prophecy about Eretz Yisrael. Is that right, Mason? Do you remember? You think that's right. Okay, so we have like two sort-ofs, right? It's actually going to be, we're going to get to this, but you know, another crucial distinction is the argument is going to be, which again may strike you as sort of surprising, prophecy only is about, prophecy is only in Eretz Yisrael, except for rare occasions when it's about Eretz Yisrael. Right? That's again, the sort of, you can call it this way, right? Maybe think about it this way. In your own sort of theological universe, in your own understanding of religion, what's the relationship between sort of the claim that everything and everywhere is in some sense suffused with the divine presence? Right? Some things are more so infused and some places are more so infused. Right? By the way, I think every Jewish theology that wants to remain true to Jewish sources has to wrestle with some version of that dialectic, right? Is every place in the world holy because it's God's, or is Eretz Yisrael in some way more holy? I want to underline that in some way, because we'll talk about that. The answer to that question is yes, right? Is all time holy, or is Shabbat uniquely holy? Yes, right? Those are core dialectics in Jewish theology. I don't think you can really avoid that unless you're going to move beyond the way Jewish texts think about this in this very kind of polar way. So, I know I didn't really answer your question, but I fumbled at it. Okay, let's take one more. Do you?
Here's though, Yehuda HaLevi takes it one step further here, because even though we don't directly receive prophecy any longer, he has this second part. Those who are not successful strove to push by means, basically, good deeds, by acting properly in the world. And there is that component of holiness, that the direct relationship with God is in part prophecy, but in part to be the intermediaries of a message of how to lead a proper life, how to improve the world, etc., etc. And that becomes,
right.
and that is sort of another level of holiness, and one that still exists even after the end.
Okay, so maybe we could say, I think that's an interesting comment, maybe we could say that proximity to the prophetic has its own intrinsic holiness. Okay, I think that's interesting. I want to think about that more. I know there are more comments. I'm going to keep taking comments as we go, but let me try to sort of keep pushing along a little bit. Now, where does this begin to get, let's say, one step messier for many people? Or let me say it this way. Where do we begin to realize how seriously Yehuda HaLevi means this is when he begins to deal with a major theological challenge for him, which is, wait a second. if only Jews can be prophets, and if halakha permits conversion, can converts be prophets? This is a major dilemma for the Kuzari. Right? Where, as it were, I want to say it this way, the halachic conception of Jewishness and the maybe purely biological conception of Jewishness begin to rub up against each other. Right? Does that make sense, the way I'm articulating that? Right? Because if there is a biological component here, or maybe to use language that's less loaded, an ontological meaning of Jewishness, there's something in the being of Jews that is distinct. Ah, but people convert to Judaism. There's something, what happens? Right? Is their biology altered in that moment? And Yehuda Halevi says, right? Let's look at the third source on the, okay? This is part one, paragraph 27. Any Gentile who joins us unconditionally shares our good fortune without, however, being quite equal to us. Ach lo yesh shaveh imanu. Now, you know, this is, by the way, every joke I have ever made about the Upper West Side, I now feel validated in. I mean, seriously, people, let's learn a text for a second, okay? Okay? By the way, what'd you say?
Maybe you could retire all that stuff.
Wouldn't you love that, Eric? Wouldn't you love that? Okay, so it's interesting, by the way, it tells you a lot about cultural context. There are places where I could read this line and be like, pshita, right? Of course that's true, yeah. Right? Now, okay, hang on, okay? The next sentence is where you're going to run up against sort of medieval discourse in ways that are sort of troubling. If the Torah were binding on us only because God created us, the white and the black man would also be equal, since he created them all. Right? Okay, now, it's actually funny that there's some scholarly discussion about whether Yehuda Halevi's theory of Jewishness is racist, and whether that term is usually applied to the Middle Ages, and it almost never talks about this sentence, because that's not the question. It's sort of like Pshita medievals talk like that. Whites and blacks are not the issue. Everybody in the Middle Ages assumed that, right? Please don't hear this as remotely apologetic about that point. I'm just, right? But the question of Jews versus Gentiles, that's more messy, right? Because it's not obvious that someone's going to make that argument. Right, does that make sense? It's not to like excuse that, but it's like actually very striking how you're going to read full scholarly articles about, you know, is Yehuda Halevi's theory of Jewishness racist? This line never comes up. So it's very striking. Okay? And then, but the Torah was given to us because he led us out of Egypt and remained attached to us because we are the pick of mankind. I don't know how to translate that really. Anachnu nikra'im hasgula mibnei Adam. I can tell you, like, for example, as I've, over the years, learned Rav Kook's writings, I really still have no idea how to render segula in English. I'm just not sure. Pick of mankind, maybe that's right. I don't know. And then finally, he says the same thing again. More explicitly, those who become Jews do not take equal rank with born Israelites who are specially privileged to attain to prophecy. While the former can only achieve something by learning from them, and can only become pious and learned, but never prophets. David, this goes to your point. They can actually achieve proximate holiness, let's call it, but not sort of full holiness. But here's where even Yehuda Halevi can't allow himself to say this. Because the children of converts can totally receive prophecy. That doesn't work biologically. Right? On some level, the halakhic ethos of prophecy, or let's call it the sort of covenantal theory where it's some degree about will, about the decision to enter a relationship with God, rubs up against the biological. In the first generation, the biological wins. By the second generation, the covenantal halachic wins. There's something interesting about that. I'm not sure that is like a philosophically worked out point. It's almost like you become assimilated biologically in some way. By the way, there are thinkers in the 20th century. Michael Wiesegrad is the most famous one, prominent Orthodox thinker, who basically understands since it is core to Jewishness that there is a biological component. Afterwards, one becomes a Jew by birth, not by faith, right? So Wiesegrad famously says the only way to understand theologically, again, according to Wiesegrad, the process of conversion, is to simply see it as a miracle. Where one becomes a different person than one was. By the way, you can invoke classical Jewish language for this. To use, you know, one of the many phrases that Jews tend to avoid because it sounds so Christian to them, all of the discourse about conversion being tinok shenolad, being born again, right? Mm-hmm. Being something than what that one wasn't before. Okay? Again, I'm not endorsing this view at this moment. I'm trying to lay it out. So again, there's a distinction. Jews alone are sort of wired to receive prophecy. Distinction is taken so seriously that converts can not receive prophecy, but I'm sort of adding as a footnote, the children of converts can. Okay? Now, we now know, just give me a moment, okay? We now know, fairly definitively, I think, we now know that the Rambam, although he doesn't quote it, read the Kuzari. And in many ways, we can sort of say that the Rambam, among other people, was declaring war on the Kuzari. And its understanding of the notion that there is essential holiness in the world. I'll explain what I mean by that in just a few moments. But I want to introduce the Rambam in a way that is sort of more complicated than the Rambam rejects Halevi on this point because the Rambam is more universalist. I want to say something different, which is the Rambam is going to say something that we're going to see that I will just sort of predict that 99% of people in this room will say, wait a second, that's not Judaism. Okay, some of you may have thought about what we just read, but now we see about the Rambam, and you say that's not Judaism either. And that is effectively, let's look at this first source. And I want to just focus very carefully on this sentence. Okay? From his Perush HaMishnayot, written already when he is quite young. V'chasher yu kayamim la'adam kol ha'yisodot halalu ve'emunato bahem amitit. When the foundations of Jewish belief are completely rationally understood by a person and affirmed by him, he enters the community of Israel. I want to translate this more straightforwardly as he becomes a Jew. And then all of the covenantal imperatives of loving one's Jewish neighbor apply. Now, it's easy to read this fast and be completely miss what the Rambam has just said. That is, I want to talk about it this way. It is anti-halachic in the extreme. The Rambam just said that the way you become a Jew is to believe in and rationally demonstrate to yourself certain beliefs about God. The Rambam has zero source for this claim. This is his own understanding, right? Someone who does not believe those things is not merely a heretic. Metaphysically, no, sorry, that's actually not a good way of saying it. Theologically speaking, at least, that person is not a Jew. Now, one of the problems the Rambam will have in thinking about conversion, thinking about all kinds of things, is he knows that halachic tradition says something different from what he's saying. Right? According to halacha, my mother's Jewish, I'm Jewish. The Rambam says, you're not Jewish, actually, unless you believe the things that I am telling you are the basic beliefs that bring you into the Jewish people. This is a totally revolutionary claim. It is so revolutionary, in fact, that nobody after the Rambam picks it up or accepts it. Nobody. Right? Now, So now, I want to sort of make clear. This is anti-essentialistic to the core. Right? There is nothing at all intrinsic. I'm not even Jewish by birth, let alone holy by birth. At least not this strand of the Rambam. I'm not Jewish by birth. By the way, here's the irony. For someone who detested Christianity as a form of idolatry, this sounds an awful lot like a Christian way of thinking about what membership looks like. Right? It's one of the great paradoxes in the Rambam, right? How do you become a Christian, right? Okay, well, it depends who we're talking to, but some form of accepting something, right? That's as abstract and all-inclusive novel as I can draw, right? Some form of accepting something involving the truth about Christ. Is that okay, right? Here the Rambam says, how do I become a Jew? Cognitively demonstrating to myself and affirming certain basic theological claims. That's what makes me Jewish. Now, I don't want to endorse this view either, but I'm bringing this to you, first of all, because I want to sort of, for a moment, just look at the sheer chasm here, right, between these two figures. But also, you know, I want a little bit to undermine the temptation to say, oh, you know, Yehuda Levi makes me very nervous. I'm going to run and, like, let the Rambam hold me. Well, you know what? The Rambam's, you know, problem with the, with, you know, if you want to adopt the Rambam now is, you know, you go to your average liberal synagogue, and, you know, when you think about what the Rambam thinks, our basic claims, by the way, forget about liberal synagogues, your average Orthodox synagogues. You think about what the Rambam thinks you have to believe in order to be Jewish, you're basically praying with a room full of goyim. No, it's actually not a joke. I mean, I think it's very profound. The Rambam here is saying something I think quite astonishing. And let's look at one more version of it, and then I'll take some sort of comments about it. So famously, Exodus 19 contains those verses. You'll be my choice treasure among the nations. And Vatem Tiuli Mamlechet Kohanim Begoy Kadosh. You will be my kingdom of priests and holy nation. Now, in the Guide of the Perplexed, the Rambam, you know, never wrote a Perush on Chumash, but he was writing Perush on Chumash all the time, right? So in the Guide of the Perplexed, he says the following thing. I'll just read the second line. When God sent Moshe Rabbeinu to turn us into Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, how? Through coming to know God. Right? There's nothing intrinsic. We're not intrinsically holy. We have the potential to turn into holy. How? By coming to affirm and fully internalize certain philosophical truths about God. By the way, that's probably why Hilchot Yisodei Torah, the beginning of the Mishneh Torah, begins with four chapters of, right, metaphysics. That's how the Torah starts for the Rambam. Here's what you have to believe in order for the rest of this to even really matter for you. It's actually amazing, by the way. We're going to talk about the universalist piece of this in a second. The Rambam does not mention the word Yisrael in the fifth chapter of Hilchot Yisodei Torah, if I remember correctly. Someone can check me on this. Where there is the discussion of the need for a people who are willing to sanctify God's name in the world. But the truths the Rambam knows are fully universal. Now, I'm just going to throw the following sentence out as like a stick of dynamite, and you know, if it takes people take it up, that's fine, and if not, that's also fine. So, if you said, but wait a second, Yehuda Levi said, you can't know God without revelation. And here the Rambam is saying, here are the things you can know philosophically. What Yehuda Levi would say is, the Rambam, the God you know, is not the God of Torah. You're basically talking about who created the world. You're not talking about a God who loves Israel, interferes in history, is engaged in the world, right? You, in fact, the Rambam, you don't have the God of the Bible. Yehuda Levi would not have been the first and certainly not the last to make that point, right? And we're gonna think that out in a minute about why that is so important, because it has really interesting repercussions for questions of particularity and universality. I want to take two questions now. People have had their hands. Please, yes. If I heard your question correctly, it's because you're trying to integrate Halevi and Rambam, and it's coming out contradictory, and that's the point.
Yeah.
And that's the point, meaning that they're irreconcilable in some way, right? Mm-hmm. That the Rambam is the sort of rejection of Halevi, kind of as it were, like on steroids in this very extreme way. That's your point. The Rambam here, at least, of course. Now, again, I want to just reiterate, since you brought the issue up of the halachic status of a non-Jew. I'm not aware. You can tell me if you think I'm wrong about this. That any tshuva where the Rambam actually wants to try to import this into halachic reality, to say, oh, you don't believe, you're actually not Jewish halachically. Go find your average, I'm joking here, right? Go find a Reform rabbi and make them your Shabbos goy, right? Right? Or go find an Orthodox rabbi who knows nothing about theology and make them your Shabbos. He's never going to say that, because he knows that on some level he's philosophically out on some totally wild limb. And yet you sort of wonder that he wish he could do that. By the way, the place where it does come up is the Rambam, I think, tell me if I'm wrong here, on his own,
sort of tries to change the process of how you talk to a potential convert by amping up how much you have to tell them about theology. Really focus on that a lot, he says. That's him. Because, right, that's not really Chazal, that's him. Sort of saying, well, of course you have to talk about that to a convert a lot because you want them to actually be Jewish, not just technically be Jewish. By the way, this point is, I see, you know, here's the reason I said sort of Reform and Orthodox Rabbi like this. The beginning of the letter on resurrection, Maimonides' treatise on resurrection, is amazing, where the Rambam basically talks about this is like a good example of how not to win friends and influence people. He basically says, you know, the majority of the rabbis are pagans, right? Because they keep halakha, but they don't know a damn thing about metaphysics. They're all pagans. One of my favorite phrases that the Rambam uses on a few occasions is a hamon harabani. I don't know what that means. If that means the masses of rabbis or the masses of people who follow rabbis, I think it actually means the masses of rabbis. But right? Hamon harabani, man. I mean, that is like as disdainful as it gets because they're not philosophers. They don't know what you have to know to be Jewish, let alone to be a Jewish leader. Yeah. Last comment for now, please, Richard.
Well, isn't the Rambam also the one who, when he was still a young man, said those who were forcibly converted, not granted with Islam, so it's probably maybe not so far, but they were for those who were forcibly converted come back and didn't have to convert back in. They never lost being Jewish.
Yeah. So I don't want to get. I don't want to totally go there, other than to say, like, the interesting question one would have to think about there is that a sort of political policy or a derivative of a theological claim. I don't know the answer to that. I just don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's not a coy. I'm not sure. Okay. Let's. So here. What is at stake here for a minute? And I want to sort of draw this out as clearly as I can. A couple of implications of this. First of all, there's something I think kind of a beautiful, creative misreading of a text. Famous rabbinic proverb: "Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek la'olam haba." All Jews have a share in the world to come. The Rambam understands that actual phrase to mean only those who have a share in the world to come are Jews. That is, only because how do you get a share in the world to come? By affirming these metaphysical truths. That is not how you usually think about Olam Haba in Jewish culture. Rambam is, let's say, hyper-intellectual in a sense. You achieve Olam Haba by knowing certain truths about the world. So, it's actually, he's almost like he's saying, Kol mi sheyesh lo chelek olam haba, hu v'rak hu Yisrael. Right? It's a total play on, right, what it means to be a member of the Jewish people. So in the Rambam here, in other words, is not biology, of course, but belief. But here is the paradox. The paradox is that the Rambam is enabled to, as we'll see in a moment, end up in a very universalistic place. And here's the thing. If the core truths that get you into Olam Haba are available to reason alone, you shouldn't really have to be Jewish to do that. And so on some level, anybody who is a accomplished rational philosopher can achieve the level of being worthy of Olam Haba just as much as any Jew. Okay? Now, here's the problem that I want to just sort of make sure we understand for a minute. Because some of us might want to say, oh, the Rambam is a hero, this is universalism. The problem or the complexity here is the Rambam purchases his universalism at the cost of an almost unimaginable elitism. Right? Because the line that now distinguishes humanity most fundamentally is not Jew versus Gentile, it's the rationally accomplished, extremely small elite, and everybody else, Jews and non-Jews. Now, on one level, it solves Yehuda HaLevi's problem. On another level, it just imports its own version of it. Right? That's, like, I think, a very important and interesting challenge that the Rambam has. This actually came up even in the world of scholarship. When Menachem Kellner famously wrote a book called Maimonides on Judaism and the Jewish People, where he sort of tried to say the Rambam is the great hero for universalism, and several other reviewers basically said, yeah, for the 27 people who make it. Right? They don't have to be Jews, but really, you're not really wrestling with, like, how exclusivist this is in some fundamental way. Right? Now, but I want to draw on this universalism for a second, because I actually think, even if you were to bracket the whole preoccupation with metaphysics and cognition and knowing truth, There is something going on here that is extremely interesting and that has really profound repercussions for theology, I think for spirituality, for thinking about our relationships with other religions potentially. And that is that in a way you could say that the core divide between the Rambam and Halevi really is, or it's encapsulatable, whatever you would say that, in this question. What is the defining event around which all of Jewish theology and spirituality orients itself? Is it Exodus? Good argument to be made for that. Certainly Jewish liturgy seems to suggest that. Well, it sometimes seems like all we ever do is like remember that. And then occasionally we take a break from remembering it to relive it. Right? Right? So, right? Or is the core event in sort of Jewish conception of the world the creation? Yehudah Levi is all about the idea that Judaism revolves around certain moments in history in which God has inserted God's self into the world, and the whole universe then revolves around those moments. Those are what in the Ophakonim used to call orienting events. Those are the orienting events of Jewish theology. Now, one of the consequences of focusing on moments in history is you are likely going to end up with a theology that is heavily invested in deep particularity. If the moment in which the deep truth about God becomes available to the world is Yitzhak Mitzrayim, now there are 20th century liberalizations of this, right? Where what it turns out is God as opposed to slavery and all its form. There are versions of that. But classically, it is a moment of God intervening to create a unique relationship with a unique people that begins at Exodus and goes to Sinai. Now, for the Rambam, and this is one of the things that maybe makes him accessible to many people in a certain way who have trouble with thinking about a God who interferes in history or intervenes in history in some way, the core event that is the defining moment of Jewish theology and spirituality is Briat HaOlam. After all, as Halevi might say about the Rambam, well, sure, you're saying that you don't really believe in the other things. Right or wrong, that's what those critics might say. Now, if that's the case, if the issue is Briat HaOlam, if the issue is the creation of the world, then your fundamental category you're working with is the human rather than the Jewish in particular. Right? You can't talk about creation, you're talking about the human. Which is why the Rambam keeps finding himself in these hyper-universalistic places around what's in theory possible, regardless of whether you're Jewish. Right? That will be extremely fundamental to him. Because in the end, he's not oriented around primarily events that are unique in Jewish history. Or that are unique interventions in history on behalf of the Jewish people. So that's what enables profound universality. Here's the problem that anyone who's a universalist in this way has, right? That's great. You know, in our 21st century context, we want to sort of cheer that on in some way, right? Problem is, any theology that begins, like, very stubbornly and forcefully at the universal ends up tripping up to some degree or another on the question of how do I make the leap from the universal to the actual real significance of a particular and of this particularity as opposed to any other. I immediately invite the question, okay, so why this? I don't need this. Right? If it's really about creation, fine, so I'm a Muslim. Right? Now, some people might like that and say, oh, this is a profound 21st century possibility. Other people might say, yeah, but this is a prescription for diluted passion about any particular tradition. Right? The universal has the potential to be deeply diluting of actual particularistic religious identity or any other kind of identity. It may be a price worth paying. It may not. Right? That, in the end, leave that to people to sort of, you know, tease out and think about on your own. But that's, I think, a very kind of fascinating way of thinking about this. Let's put it in another way. You know, classically, Jews talk about, you know, Judaism affirms the God of history. Yeah, except the Rambam, I don't think that's actually true. The Rambam's God is fundamentally the God of creation in some very fundamental way. I'm oversimplifying somewhat, but I don't think I'm oversimplifying too much here. I think the core is actually accurate and as a helpful way of framing this. There are other pieces of this too, right? When you begin with the universal, when you begin with creation, when you begin with the human, it is not a great leap to then conclude that mitzvot have to make sense according to rational canons, right? Which has become so important to the Rambam in the Guide of the Perplexed, and in Book 3, beginning in Chapter 26, I think it is, right? This whole kind of theory of all of mitzvot have to make sense and be understandable by, even if not necessarily observed by, they have to be understandable by anyone who's thinking. After all, as Sefer Dvarim says, right? Gentiles should be able to see this and say, how wise is this nation? How will they say that if mitzvot are completely irrational? They're merely some kind of divine mystery rooted in God's own capricious, or even not capricious, but unavailable, esoteric understanding. So again, just to sort of see where we've come here, right? What seems like a discussion about, well, are Jews intrinsically holy? Are, right, is everyone holy? No, that's actually exactly not what I want to say. Are Jews intrinsically holy? Or is holiness something that one aspires to and becomes? Is in some way derivative of a more fundamental question, I want to suggest. It's a more fundamental question about sort of, are we oriented around particularity all the way down? Or does particularity find itself in the context of a frame that is fundamentally universal? That, I think, is actually like a really important question. Now, I will leave the theologians in the room, right, to figure out in your own mind how you can take the Rambam's universality without necessarily that sort of revolutionary Christian-ish understanding of how one becomes a Jew. Or can you not do that and all of a sudden you find yourself more sympathetic with Yehuda Levi? By the way, before you condemn Yehuda Levi, if you have ever said the sentence to someone that involved the phrase apinta leyid, you have articulated a version of ontological Jewishness. Maybe unknowingly, maybe unwittingly, but that's effectively a form of ontological Jewishness. It says there's something in the person, right? It just needs to be awakened, but it's there, right? It's part of it. Now all of a sudden it's like, oh, right? Because grandma said that, right? You don't have to be a theologian or a complicated philosopher to have some version of that afloat. So if you reject Yehuda Halevi and love the notion of Pintel Yed, I give you the challenge of writing out for yourself how you do that. I'm not saying it's not doable, but it's actually an important question. Okay, now, yeah, one question, and then we're going
to
proceed. Can you speak up a tiny drop? I'm sorry.
It seems to me there's also another kind of difference between the two, which is that Yehuda Halevi ends up with a more community definition, as opposed to the Rambam ends up with a more individual definition.
100%. That's 100% right. Yes, I mean, that's a great point, and we could talk about that at some length. I think it's true. You know, it's almost like, you know, the Mishnah is obsessed with the notion that Adam was created as a single person. The Rambam's spirituality is, in some sense, extremely individual. That's, you know, Avraham's heroism for the Rambam is precisely that he becomes the individual who discovers God on his own. And extremely tellingly, in the Rambam's telling of Avraham's life at the beginning of the Laws of Idolatry, there's no revelation there at all. Till the very, right? In Avram's story, there's no revelation at all. Avram philosophically discovers God. Crucially for the Rambam, those have nothing to do with halakha. He wants no part of that rabbinic notion that the avot form the mitzvot. Because, now here, by the way, here's another stick of dynamite that Rambam throws in the Jewish philosophy, and people throw it right back in his face. Well, you're basically saying that someone can merely by being a philosopher discover God and achieve greatness. Have you not just declared the entire system of Torah and Mitzvot expendable in some way? The entire medieval tradition attacks the Rambam on this point. Now, here's another very simple version of it. If you're going to give me an explanation for every last mitzvah, what are you going to do when I say to you, oh, that's great, so I'm going to choose this means for getting to that end? Isn't it, so this is interesting, right? Isn't it the case that if you give me a rationale for the mitzvot, on some level you have opened the door to seeing them as expendable? Whereas, if you say, with you and Aleinu, the mitzvot have some, thank you very much, have some divine mystery attached to them, which cannot be rationally understood, which attaches us in some kind of proximity, to use my spin on David's comment before, to God, then the mitzvot are obviously not expendable. They're almost magical in some way. It's not rational, but it's a good argument for observing mitzvot. I'm not saying not rational dismissively, meaning it's not a rationalistic understanding of their nature. Okay? So in other words, people who are in this yeshiva know that I like to say ad nauseum, one of the challenges of Jewish philosophy is that you can't really talk about anything without talking about everything, right? And this is an example of this. How much is at stake in... We started out with what seems like a very simple question, right? Hardware or software? But actually, it derives from, and in turn has repercussions for, everything. Okay, let me just push forward for a moment. Now, I want to just show you where I think the Rambam plays this out most explicitly and dramatically, and I wish we had more time to do it. At the end of Hilchot Shemitah V'Yovel, the laws of Shemitah, the Rambam famously says this thing that stuns his commentators into silence. He's actually playing with a rabbinic image here, but he's expanding it amazingly. He starts out, the second to last law of the laws of Shemitah is a description of how holy the Levites are. They have been set aside by God to be God's own portion. Okay? And then Halakha 13, this is the very end, he says the following. I guess I'm going to read this in English again. Not only the tribe of Levi, but any one of the inhabitants of the world, Ba'ei Olam, whose spirit generously motivates him. I love that translation. And he understands with his wisdom to set himself aside and stand before God to serve him and minister to him and know God, proceeding justly as God made him, removing from his neck the yoke of the many reckonings which people seek, he is sanctified as holy of holies. You need not be a Jew to be Kodesh Kodashim like the Kohen Gadol. You merely need to dedicate your life to God, and that's true about any human being, not just Jews. This is the passage in the Mishnah Torah. I mean, I've thought about this a lot. You read the Mishnah Torah, and there's this whole collection of commentators, Nosei Kelim on the Rambam. They all spend all their time citing things the Rambam quoted, bringing up things the Rambam didn't quote. They get to this line, and they all fall into silence. I think they're sort of just stunned by it, except for a few achronim, a few later. But in other words, people are just like, what? Really? You are the Kohen Gadol. But again, I think the Rambam understands this to be the consequence of being focused on, right, simply being created human with reason is in some fundamental way enough. Now again, can you detach, if you are so inclined, this kind of universalism from being focused on sort of a hyper-philosophical rationalism? Do those things necessarily come together? I'm not sure they do. Okay? So God will be his portion and his heritage forever and will provide what is sufficient for him in this world as he provides for the priests and the Levites, etc. Okay? Now, just for a minute, look at David Hartman's comment on this passage. Simply stated, neither ethnicity nor biology is an essential condition for becoming Nachalat Hashem, God's portion and inheritance. All who walk in the spiritual ways of Abraham share the same holiness as the tribe of Levi. Kiddushah holiness is not a genetic property unique to the people of Israel. Although the service of God was institutionalized and holiness turned into a property legally defined by biology, geography, and nationality, a deeper understanding of Kiddushah, that is what the Rambam gestures towards here, posits a universal ideal transcending racial and national distinctions and ritual forms of worship. This, in another year, one of the most interesting questions in Rambam scholarship, I find, and there's still a fair bit of debate about this, is does the Rambam think that Muslims are equally B'nai Abraham in theological terms as Jews are? And a lot depends on how you read a couple of the Rambam's letters. There's actually an extremely poignant letter that the Rambam writes to Ovadia the proselyte. It's the letter, the other letter to Ovadia the proselyte. Everybody knows one of the letters, which is where he tells his proselyte, you, of course, can say Eloheinu, right? Eloheinu, Eloheinu, Avotainu, the God of our fathers. The other one, he gets a letter from Ovadia the proselyte saying, I have a friend who basically tells me that because I converted from Islam to Judaism, I have really taken an enormous step downhill, etc., etc. And the Rambam ends up saying something in that letter, if I remember, it's extremely kind of moving. He says, just because they say bad things about us, I will not return the favor. right? Islam is absolutely monotheism. Islam is, in fact, one of the great anxieties of the Rambam's life, I think, is that he thought Muslims were more rigorous monotheists than most Jews he knew, right? What he doesn't like is what he thinks of is the sexual dissoluteness of Islamic culture, and it's hard to know whether that's actually like a sociological claim he's making or whether it's he's nervous about, he's glorified Islam to such a great extent that he now needs to tear it down. Now, but if you read his letter to Obadiah Gair, it's amazing. You know, he wants to sort of insist on the dignity and theological status of Islam, and then it's like almost like he has a moment of panic, because at a certain point Obadiah is going to write him back and say, well, why don't I become a Muslim again then? What's the point? Why did I convert here? But the power is the question of exactly what it means for the Rambam to be a child of Abraham. Is that a claim of being biologically, you know, Muslims are also biologically descended from Abraham, so it's even more complicated. But is it about a claim of descent, or is it a claim of spiritual descent? Okay, that's for another day and another conversation. Okay, now, another way of saying this is that holiness here becomes a status achieved rather than a quality one intrinsically has. Okay, now, it is common in more, I would say, now jumping very far, okay? It is common in liberal religious Zionist circles, or what's left of them. I'm not saying that, it's just a very small intellectual community right now. It is common among liberal religious Zionist circles to want to insist on, we should really embrace the Rambam as opposed to Halevi. Because in a time when a lot of religious Zionist discourse, so they argue, has become tinged with racism, it's extremely important that we reassert the centrality of the Rambam's focus on creation, on the human as the fundamental category, which is in some fundamental sense prior to the Jewish. For example, Menachem Kellner, who I mentioned before, his book, it's actually kind of a fascinating exercise in polemics. He writes this entire book about medieval Jewish philosophy, right? Says nothing about the 20th century except the blurb on the back cover, right? In a time in which, in Eretz Yisrael, things have gotten so, et cetera, we want to sort of restore the universal. But here's something that is sort of interesting about this. By the way, I want to bracket right now the conversation about religious Zionism. You can, you know, hear my, more than you want to hear my thoughts about the history of religious Zionism online. It's what I really spend a lot of my time thinking about. It is actually not Halevi who is the basis for those strands of religious Zionism that end up saying, I'll use a gentle word, essentialistic statements about the difference between Jews and non-Jews. It is almost entirely the Zohar and the history of Kabbalah. And what I want to sort of mention for a moment here is that the Rambam Halevi antinomy, this kind of dichotomy is sort of the standard one to draw. But if I called Halevi the soft hardware distinction, I would call the Zohar and much of Kabbalah the hard hardware distinction, where you end up having this extremely robust insistence on utter metaphysical difference between Jews and Gentiles. Now, I know, if you've only ever learned Kabbalah by, like, reading, you know, Zalman Shachter Shalomi or whatever, you don't know this. I'm not saying this dismissively. But in other words, the sort of 21st century liberal Jewish approbations of Kabbalah obviously elide all of that. There's a paradox, which I talked about with my Jewish thought class the other day, that I think is one of the central paradoxes of Jewish intellectual history that has never really been fully unpacked or even addressed, right? And that is that part of the tradition that most prided itself on seeing the utter inner unity of all faiths, Sfirat Chochmah, utter unity of all things, has also been that strand of the tradition that has been utterly obsessed with rigid metaphysical hierarchies. It is extremely odd and interesting. It is very hard to understand. There's a lot to sort of say about that speculatively, but that awaits full understanding, right? How is it that Kabbalah, which is all about, on some level, seeing utter unity, right, beyond Alma de Piruta, seeing through everything that seems to be separate, also has this unbelievably rigid Jews over Gentiles, males over females. Right? If you're a male Jew in Kabbalah, you got a lot going for you. Right? There's something extremely hard to figure out about that. No one ever really talks about that. Even in academia, they don't really. I mean, everybody knows it. So everybody writes your articles about, oh, the image of the Gentile in Kabbalah, right? This is like one of those troubling parts of the Jewish tradition. But there's actually, I think, a much more interesting sort of philosophical, even psychological question about what's going on there. What is actually going on when you like insist that there are no distinctions ultimately, and at the same time, you are way more focused on utter absolute metaphysical distinctions than any other part of the tradition? It's weird. Right? It's like really, it requires a lot of thought. Now, I say this because if you were to read those parts of religious Zionist sources that fall into talking about, you know, Jews are a totally different entity, they are atzmuta, they are a different kind of being than non-Jews, that is totally Zoharic language. It is not Yehuda HaLevi language. That's sort of a blaming Yehuda HaLevi for that, I think, is actually not fair. By the way, there's also a fabulous paradox about the religious Zionist embrace of Yehuda HaLevi. When Tzvi Yehuda Cook talks all the time about Yehuda HaLevi as Kodesh Kodashim, he's the Holy of Holies, Yehuda HaLevi is actually the medieval thinker who basically says, you know what would redeem us? If we accepted Galut without any problem at all, just embrace it wholeheartedly, and then God would redeem us. It is so much not a precedent for a Zionist form of religion. It's amazing, right? But because Yehuda HaLevi has such a rich notion of the uniqueness of the Jews and of the land, that overrides the fact that on some level, his way of understanding Jewish spirituality is, now to be wildly anachronistic, anti-Zionist in the extreme, right? It's in some fundamental way waiting for God, okay? Now, I want to share with you two examples of what I mean by this. And I do this with tremendous hesitation because my goal here is not to make anyone a villain. It's to show you how much in Jewish thought you have these moments that are extremely troubling and require deep wrestling with. Now, the first source is going to be from Rav Cook, and I want to actually say something about Rav Cook. That is the father, not Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Everyone, many people have heard me say, the best title for an article in the history of Jewish studies is an Israeli sociologist named Gidon Aran, whose first article, I think it was, about Gush Emunim that he spent his life studying was called The Father, the Son, and the Holy Land. which was, right, this is an amazing title for an article. Walt Whitman's declaration about containing multitudes has been truer about no Jew so much as about Rav Cook. Because if you want to look for some of the most sort of startlingly and breathtakingly universalist, filled with love for the whole world formulations in the history of the Jewish tradition, you can look at Rav Cook. And if you want to find some of the most starkly, and here in the 20th century I will use this language, racist understandings of Judaism, you can look often two paragraphs away. It's extremely interesting. In some ways, it's a 20th century manifestation of the very thing I was talking about the sort of Kabbalah and the inner unity, right? The same Rav Cook who says, you know, look, I don't need a text for this. You want to be a spiritual person, it's about learning to love everything that God created. That's the whole thing on some level, right? We'll then also say, look at the next source. This is the worst paragraph in all of Rav Cook. I just want to sort of say, like, I'm just trying to... I have del shebein ha-neshama ha-israelit, atzmiyuta, me'aveh ha-pni'im, she'ifata, tchunata ve'emdata. The difference between a Jewish soul, its essence, its desires, its yearnings, its character, its status, uvein nishmat hagoyim kulam, between that and the soul of all of the non-Jewish nations, l'chol dargoteim, on all of their various statuses, hu yoter gadol v'yoter amok mehayevdel shebein nefesh ha'adam v'nefesh ha'behima. Okay? Right? The distinction between a Jewish soul and a Gentile soul is greater than the distinction between a Gentile soul and the soul of an animal. Now, I obviously don't want to apologize for this source. Again, I don't want to demonize this source either, actually. I just want to sort of see here, this is, let's call this essentialism sort of in its most hyper-extreme, right? This is sort of like that strand of Kabbalah taken to its most kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, like, you know, over-the-top manifestation. But I introduced this source partially because I think we should be extremely cautious about simply assuming that Yehuda HaLevi and this are the same thing. Yehuda HaLevi in 1,000 years would never have written this sentence. I suspect would have been appalled by it.
It's funny, a very close friend of mine who has spent his entire life, more or less, or his entire academic career writing about Rav Kook, has said to me on several occasions, and he has tremendous reverence for Rav Kook, he has said to me on several occasions that if he ever could have Rav Kook alone in a room, the one question he would want to say to him is simply put this sentence in front of him and say, Bemet? Really? You wrote this? Really? Seriously? Like, you actually think this? And it's complicated because, I am sometimes tempted to ask people who say things like, I don't know what I believe, or, I no longer believe this. Well, how many different philosophers are inside of you at the same time having this argument? Like, what percentage of you believes in God? So I think actually, we live in a time where understanding the, irreducible complexity and multiplicity of the human self. So yes, the same person who says that to be a religious person is to learn to love every living thing also says that the soul of a Gentile is in some sense closer to the soul of a beast than to the soul of a Jew. Now, you can say that person is irreducibly complicated. So then I would say, you know what, you give me 5 hours with you on the couch and we'll see where we get. Meaning, I'm not trying, people are complicated. Again, I'm certainly not saying this to apologize for this, because I also want to emphasize, and this is something that's very important to me, and I've talked about this a lot in lectures on religious Zionism all over the place. I think it is very different to say certain things in a time when you are fundamentally powerless and in a way taking metaphysical revenge for your diminished political status on the one hand and saying it when you have all the tanks. It is a very different thing. And not here making some kind of argument about leftist politics or rightist politics. I'm just trying to talk about how context matters for ideas. It's always very important. I always think it's very important for people who want to condemn the Kuzari to always remember what no one remembers. What is the subtitle of the Kuzari? A defense of the despised religion. It is extremely important for understanding what HaLevi is doing there. Yes, I started out by saying there's a philosophical thing that leads him to that, but I think there's also an existential thing. You Christians and you Muslims are elevated over us in every conceivable way. And if you think that's not a theological challenge for us, a spiritual challenge, it is. It's very hard. Right? But you know what? Yeah. In the metaphysical truth of the universe, you're nothing. That's actually, personally, I have tremendous compassion for that. I just think it's very different when you quote that in the B'nai Akiva yeshiva, totally without any reservation, 800 years later, where things are totally different. Right? Ideas, the context of ideas matters. So, similarly with the Zohar. I don't want to apologize for Zohar. I want to understand there's a difference between a medieval text and the citation of that text in a certain contemporary context. If you want to look, and I'm going to really run out of time here, so if you want to look, you can, but you should do this, cautiously. The next source, which we're not going to read, is one of Rav Kook's students, Rav Yaakov Charlap. This is probably the most, this is not the most extreme statement in Rav Kook, this is the most extreme statement I have ever seen in a Jewish source about the distinction between Jews and Gentiles in this extremely kind of disturbing way, right? But how there is nothing at all in common between a Jew and a Gentile. Okay? This is anti-Maimonidean in the extreme. And I also want to emphasize, this is something that, for those of you who are in my summer Jewish thought class, it is anti-biblical in the extreme. Right? Because the Bible absolutely has no notion of any kind of ontological distinction between Jews and Gentiles. None. Okay? I just want to sort of make that clear. Now, I want to just, more briefly than I had hoped, talk about the parallel to this, which is the debate about what is the meaning of the land of Israel in Jewish thought and Jewish culture. And, as a way of just bringing us into this, let's not treat this, at least as first, as a philosophical question. Let's treat it as an emotional question. Have you ever been the person, or at least met the person, who comes home from their first trip to Israel and says something like, I was totally skeptical going into this.
But like, I got off the plane and I like had this urge to kiss the ground. If you're 25, you have no idea what I'm talking about. If you're 65, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I just wanted to like kiss the earth, right? Because I knew that like the tarmac was holy, right? Or like, you know, I went to the coast. I'm totally suspicious of all of that kind of stuff. But like, you know, I wept my eyes out. Now, by the way, I also know people who are like, this was what I've been waiting for my whole life. No, I don't feel anything here. This is just kind of weird, right? I understand there's that too. But I want to sort of point emotionally to, what does it mean to have a profound emotional sense? This place is different than any place I've ever been. Now, one of the interesting questions you might then ask is, what is the metaphysical status of that emotional response? Many of us might want to say, I'm staying out of this for now. Many of us might want to say, the metaphysical status of that emotional claim is nothing at all. It's like saying, you know, my wife is the most beautiful woman in the whole world. That is a metaphysical truth, as opposed to a deep statement of my attachment to her. Let's not be confused about the sort of metaphysical status of my emotional connections. Footnotes for those of you who are interested in this. The Israeli philosopher Dov Schwartz argues, I don't know if he's right, I really can't figure it out, that that's actually how Rabbi Soloveitchik thinks about the holiness of the land of Israel. That it's like, if you're asking me about my experience, it is totally different than any place in the whole world. If you ask me what the metaphysical status of that is, how would I know? I have no idea. I don't really believe that metaphysically. It's just how I experience it. Right. Okay, fair enough. That he says that about everything. He see. Yeah. So let's talk about this. The problem is that there's a strand of interpreting Rabbi Soloveitchik in Israel that has now come to the conclusion that he doesn't really mean almost anything that he says about anything metaphysical. Right? That's basically the Dov Schwartz reading of anyway, okay. Another conversation about post-metaphysical theology. A revelation to some, a hopeless oxymoron to others. Okay, now, guess which side I'm on. Now, okay, so, so land. Okay, now let's see what Yehuda Levi says, okay? Says the rabbi, whosoever prophesied did so, here it is, either in the land, or, as I said before, it runs to Les' question, or concerning it, namely, Abraham in order to reach it, Ezekiel and Daniel on account of it, etc. Okay? Now, I just lost my place, sorry. Okay. And then, famously, kind of playing with rabbinic images, I want to just sort of skip this for now. The land of Israel, that's the next source, lies at the center of the world, which is not an emotional statement for Yehuda Halevi. It is like a cosmic statement. Now, the Rambam is, again, extremely interesting about this. Because the Rambam, when he talks about Eretz Yisrael, does something that is, I'm now going to sort of weave together various moments in the Mishneh Torah and the Rambam's code. On the one hand, in ways that are not always characteristic of him, he just exudes emotional connection to the land of Israel. On the other hand, any opportunity he has to say that this place is somehow metaphysically distinct, that it's a different quality of being than anything else, he rejects out of hand. I think it's actually highly significant, right? In other words, he has this unbelievably emotional attachment. If you want to say, if you don't think this land is intrinsically different, you can't sustain a deep commitment to it, the Rambam is the kind of the great counterexample. In fact, I think it's actually interesting, this is really almost just a passing comment, but it's fascinating. This is one of the great moments in the Mishneh Torah where when the Rambam talks about making aliyah, which he believes is not, as far as I can tell, a halachic obligation, he then says, right, he effectively won't say it's a halachic obligation, so he does what he does when there's something he really thinks people ought to do, but it's not status of halacha, right? He just imports a whole slew of agadot from the Talmud of sort of like beautiful flourishes. It's just like, it's a really good thing to do. But his honesty precludes him from saying you're obligated to do it. Jerry Blitzstein, great scholar Rambam, basically says, I think, that in his mind there are at least two places where the Rambam does this. One is making aliyah and the other is davening in a minyan. Where the Rambam doesn't think you're obligated, but he thinks you really, 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 really ought to. So he's not going to say you're obligated, he's just going to start quoting agadot about how you really should do it. That's his immense, it's actually very moving, I think, about like the sort of the combination of like real intellectual rigor, like wanting to give, fascinatingly, this is actually crucial for Rambam, I think. This is yet another Yom Yom. The Rambam, I think, is deeply opposed to the idea
that everything Jews should do is an overlapping category with that which is halakhically required. There are some things one should really do that don't have the status of law. Then we can start wrestling with, well, what is the status exactly in a legal tradition of saying should but not law? Right? This is extremely important for thinking about the Rambam's understanding of diet and hilchot deot. Huge debates among poskei halakha. Is the Rambam saying it is halachic obligation to not eat certain things, or it is what Jews should do because you have a general obligation to take care of yourself? So, okay, that's really for another conversation. Now, what is interesting about the Rambam here is, it seems to me, it actually seems to many people who know the Rambam much better than I, so that's maybe more significant, that the Rambam thinks the holiness of the land of Israel comes from two places. First of all, it is the place where many of the formative events of Jewish history and of the Jews' relationship with God took place. And second of all, it is the place where the Torah says only certain mitzvot can only be fulfilled there. That is to say, it is a historically infused and halachically oriented holiness, but it is not in any way the claim that this is intrinsically, ontologically, right, in and of itself, holy. That is, I think, almost definitely Soloveitchik's position. It is the position of Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, the founder of Mizrahi. It's a very common view. Now, not surprisingly, the Kabbalistic view, which will have enormous importance for Rav Kook, and especially for Tzvi Yehuda Kook, his son, is, what do you mean? Eretz Yisrael, by the way, this sentence I'm about to say, I don't know what it means. I want to just actually sort of admit that. I don't know what this means. Eretz Yisrael is actually a sphira. It is actually part of the spherotic chart. It is some kind of manifestation of the divine in the world. It is a totally different thing than when you cross the line from Eretz Yisrael into Syria. I mean, there's so many jokes to be made here. I don't want to get any of them. But you have actually crossed a metaphysical divide. By the way, one of the problems that devils, I think various versions of this is, the problem that the borders of the land of Israel are fluid in the history of Jewish thought, right? So it's extremely complicated. This is actually like a famous debate among like poskim as well, right? Poskei halakha, like, okay, fine. You want to say, it even comes up in debates about land for peace in an interesting way among poskim, because you want to say, fine, you can't withdraw from the land of Israel. What is that? Right, so there's the maximalist read, which is Gulot HaHavtacha, right? There's enormous swath of the Middle East, right? And then there's all these different versions. And one of the arguments that liberals often make is, what are you even talking about when you talk about the land of Israel? What are its boundaries? They move all the time. I'm not endorsing that argument, by the way. I just want to sort of say that's like an interesting debate here. So Kabbalists have this very kind of robust sense of what is the status of the land of Israel. Now, what you have in front of you that we will not read is the place in Hilchot Melachim in the Mishneh Torah where the Rambam actually kind of gives his peroration on the status of the land of Israel and why it's so important to go there. And then we're going to sort of skip all that for now. And I want to just have us shift gears a bit. But first, it's been a while since we took questions or comments. So let's take three comments or questions, please, and then we'll
I want to go back to the paradox in the Zohar between the all we wanted. I'm reminded of the answers one gives about the different contexts and frames of reference between science and religion. Why can't one be a philosopher and also be a biologist? In other words, understand a certain unity, but still be driven to understand taxonomies and forms and genres and to put the world in order in a certain way that allows the person to function in the everyday. And well, so for the Zohar, this kind of classification of the Jew and the non-Jew functioned the way we would think of solids and gases and...
Here's the reason why I really like actually what you're trying to do with that argument. The problem for me with it is that how much the Zohar amps up the metaphysics of that hierarchy. It would be one thing if you said, I see the inner unity of all things,
But you know, in order to function in this world, I think that's the phrase they use, you know, I need certain distinctions. But that's different than basically saying, yes, you know what a human being is? A male Jew. Right? Meaning like, you know what I'm saying? In other words, like, I don't think that it's as modest as what you're saying. Those sort of, they seem to be very deeply metaphysical formulations. In other words, it's one metaphysical formulation in the face of another. So, I'm very sympathetic to what you're trying to say, but I think the Kabbalah itself is not content with that kind of distinction. It wants something deeper. And at a certain point, you are wrestling. Let's put it this way. The line there between a deep tension and an out-and-out contradiction is fine. I don't know which side it is. I think what you're trying to say is maybe there's a tension, maybe there's not even a tension. I think you have to say there's some kind of tension because they're not saying, well, the ultimate metaphysical truth of the universe is that everything is one, there is no unit, there's no distinction, but like practically we need to maintain these distinctions in legal terms. That's not what they're saying, right? They're saying something that's much more amped up than that. So I don't know. I mean, I appreciate that line of thinking. I would want to sort of talk it out more with you. I think it's interesting, but it doesn't seem to me that it does the work, or at least not enough of the work, to solve the sort of like puzzle of this a little bit. So it seems to me. Yeah, who has not spoken yet? Anyone who has not spoken? Yeah, please.
I just want to confirm, regarding the first opening question, if you do not believe in the holiness of the church, there's no intrinsic holiness, then clearly the second question about the holiness of the state of Israel does not apply, right? If people are not holy, then the place cannot be holy.
So, you know, that's a really interesting question. So I'll tell you something that I was thinking about a lot last night. Is it the fact that those questions so often come together, right? And usually people who fall out on one side of one question fall out on the same side of the other question. I was sort of trying to think this out last night. I found myself sort of puzzled by it, which is why I haven't sort of brought it up. But I'm happy to talk about it, which is like, is it fully possible to disentangle the two? And if it is, does that mean that it's possible to affirm either without the other or only one without the other? Meaning, can you affirm that the Jewish people are intrinsically holy? You're Yehuda HaLevi, but you cut out all the stuff about Eretz Yisrael. Yehuda HaLevi would not know what you were talking about, right? And conversely, can you say, you know, the land of Israel is just like a metaphysical entity, it's totally unique, but the Jewish people are not. Now, let's put it this way. Historically, I don't think you're going to find anyone who did that. I think that's true. I mean, happy people, you know, want to give me counterexamples. I don't think that you have examples of them being disentangled. Now, the first thing a philosopher will tell you is, no historical example of it doesn't mean that it's not conceptually possible.
It's logic. Isn't this an issue of logic? If A is false and B follows A, then B can...
No, the reason why is, yes, that's true, but I don't think you have to argue that B follows from A. You can argue that the land of Israel is holy separate from the holiness of the Jewish people. God built a world in which one parcel of land is other than any other parcel of land. So, pasuk.
And that is not related to Judaism. It's holy in itself, geographic.
Judaism is merely a description of metaphysical truth that transcend it or anything else. I don't want to defend this position. I'm just saying I don't see what you're saying as actually logically entailed at all. Logically, one could separate them. I'm not sure why a Jewish thinker would have ever been tempted to do that. Either you find yourself pushing against the ontologization of peoplehood and land, or you find yourself embracing of it. I mean, but that doesn't mean conceptually it would be impossible to distinguish between them. Okay? Now we're really in the world of like crazy logic. Eric, last question for now, and then I want to just come
to a little, but what am I failing to understand?
Oh, so many things. Nothing. Yeah, Eric, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You should pay me.
What'd you say? I should pay you? Yes. Eric is my straight man.
On the one hand, I heard Rabbi Hel explain to me that...
whenever he calls me Rabbi Hel, bad thing to come. Yeah. On the one hand, you heard Rabbi Hel say what?
He sees God as ineffable, impossible to understand, and just sort of there.
Wait, who sees God that way?
Maimonides.
Uh-huh, right.
On the other hand, the way to be a Jew is to have the knowledge, specifically, and that's the only way to be a Jew. So what is the knowledge? This is to be one, on the one hand, on the other hand. What's in between?
Eric, I wanted to say that you would just have witnessed Eric Alterman articulate what I think is the fundamental puzzle of the whole Maimonidean project. Right? Let me sort of try to say it this way.
Rizal, I'm nervous, but I'm going to say it anyway. Okay? Here's what I think the problem is. On some level, if you take seriously the Rambam's, I'm going to say it this way, okay? You take the utter negation of any similarity of any kind between the human and the divine, and you suggest that any construction of the divine as having anything that the human has is not just false, but is idolatrous. And then you say, but Tzelem Elohim is reason, and human beings share that with God. You have articulated something that fundamentally is in profound tension. If you want to go into La La Land, I think that's the tension between being at once a Neoplatonist and Aristotelian. Right? You, on the one hand, you want to just reject any connection at all. On the other hand, like, what is the meaning of a human life? It is like the rational cognition of metaphysical truths. Now, here's another way of saying that. I think the central puzzle in many ways for people in understanding the Moreh Nebuchim, the guy, is you have told me on the one hand that the highest achievement of a human being is the contemplation of metaphysical realities, of which you have also told me I'm capable of understanding none. That, by the way, is what has occasioned this whole strand of reading of Maimonides, which I think is not right, even though there is some truth to it, about saying, ah, yes, this is most famously associated with Hermann Cohen. What you realize when you try to understand God is only that the world is created and that God is a God of graciousness, so you should live a life of graciousness and kindness. You end up with this profoundly Jewish conclusion to that only you realize that metaphysics is a kind of is a path that leads you to the only possible conclusion, that's ethics. Now, I don't think that that's fully wrong, and that the Rambam clearly does think that the philosopher ends up in a radical commitment, although exactly the nature of it is interesting, but a radical commitment to acts of chesed in the world, right? But it doesn't seem to me that he's saying, yes, at a certain point you give up on metaphysics because you know you can't know anything. I don't think that's really a plausible reading of the guide. But your question is, like, that is it. That is, in some level, the problem of figuring out Maimonides. That is, like, really the problem. Right? That is why there is an endless literature and scholarship about what is Maimonides' conception of the good life. I'm supposed to contemplate God and come up empty. I have often thought of the following thing, which I, you know, am not, like, a professional Maimonides scholar. I'm not. But it has often occurred to me that the Rambam at moments has something like that is almost Zen-like. That what a philosopher really begins to do when he really, I'm saying he here because I think the Rambam assumes at this point that it's men, but when he really begins to understand metaphysics, he starts emptying his mind of everything he thinks he knows about God until it's totally empty. I'm saying that the Rambam thinks that one of the things that happens is a thinker comes to empty his mind of all the things he thinks he knows about God, till his mind is empty and he has achieved a state of learned ignorance. I now know that I know nothing about the divine. And that is like a profoundly spiritual state. And for the Rambam, which I think is interesting, is it culminates in profound yearning to be close to that thing I can't know. There's a lot to say there. But Eric, I that question is amazing. So first I picked on you and then I, you know, okay. Now, I want to, in the little time that we have, suggest that there's another theological dimension of this that I think is interesting to just play with, and then, you know, we can sort of call it a day, and I hope these conversations will continue to reverberate over lunch and over the course of the day, and thereafter for that matter. And that is, what are the implications for believing that God is transcendent for the possibility of something in this world being holy? Because it seems to me, as I will sort of try to show, or at least maybe I'll have to say it rather than show it, that for the Rambam, one of the meanings of believing in a God who is totally transcendent is that one of the consequences of that is that God and God alone is holy and nothing created ever could be. It can sort of journey towards embodying certain ideals that are considered holy, but nothing earthly can be holy. Everything earthly is radically relativized in some fundamental way. That's why if the land of Israel is holy, it's a halachic holiness. It's a historical holiness. But it's not an essential holiness. Because if God is holy, then nothing earthly can. Because God, this is like it says, one thing you can say about the Rambam, right? God is totally different from this world. So
I think an interesting way for thinking about this is, and I this had a very kind of very inflammatory context for a time in Israeli religious Zionist circles, which I want to sort of bracket. That's not actually what I'm interested in here. I'm interested in the sort of philosophical dimension of what was at stake in this battle. Tzvi Yehuda Cook famously argued, I've said this before to students, like it's gotten to the point now where the things that I've read a lot of times I now think of as famous. I have no idea whether this is famous at all, really. But, I mean that quite seriously, meaning like in a couple of his sermons, Tzvi Yehuda Cook ends up saying something really, really interesting, which is that the verse, Kedoshim Tiyu, you should be holy, is not only a mitzvah, but also a declaration of a fact. Right? Look, if you would, at the what's called part 4, You Shall Be Holy. You with me?
Page 8.
I'm sorry. I'm holding a packet with different page numbers. Is page 8?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm reading the first. I'm reading in the Hebrew. Atem mechuyavim mitzuvim liot kedoshim. You are obligated and commanded to be holy. V'kadashtem v'item kedoshim. You are obligated to make yourself holy. V'nimshachim mizeh arbe pratim. And a whole lot derives from that. Aval lo pachot mizeh, says Tzvi Yehuda. Not any less than this. Zo bracha, it is a blessing. Ani mevakesh mikem shekdoshim tiyu, ve'ani gam machlit shekdoshim tiyu. I ask you to be holy, but I also decide that you will be. Habitui elishoni kedoshim tiyu kolel shnei hamuvanim ha'ele. Right, the phrase "you shall be holy" contains both meanings: chiyuv v'tzivui v'gam hachlata uvracha. Right, commandment and obligation on the one hand, and a decision on the other hand. And now. The rest of this passage is also important, but I want to look at the next one for a second. Where am I here? I'm lost in my own sources. Sorry. Okay, here we go. And then again, the next source, Kedoshim Tiyu Zo Kviya Datit. This is religious coercion. He's saying this sort of tongue in cheek. Lo tuchlu limaleit mikach b'choach v'chiratchem. You have no choice here. And I also want to underline something that comes up in Tzvi Yehuda that I think is like a little jarring. Nothing you do can undo your holiness. For those of you who are in my Jewish thought class yesterday, I think for Tzvi Yehuda, the holiness of the Jewish people is parallel to Tzelem Elohim in the Bible. Nothing you can do can undo that. You just are. Okay? Al korchachem kedoshim to you. You will be holy even against your will. Zehu tzivui v'gam mitziut. This is a commandment and also a fact. Now, I have often said very many critical things about Yeshayahu Leibovitz as a Jewish philosopher in this very space. However, I think Yeshayahu Leibovitz says something that is quite amazing, and I will make copies of this available for those who want to hear it. And again, I'm interested here in the philosophical distinction. His Dvar Torah on Parshat Korach, his most famous Dvar Torah on Parshat Korach, is really like, in the realm of Torah, Yesh Koneh Olamo B'Sha'achat, right? There's someone who says one thing that is like so moving that it's, he earns a share in the world to come. So he says this really beautiful thing. He says, what is the sin of Korach? What does Korach do wrong? Well, look at the chapter before. And actually, it appears to be, this is a good example, by the way, academic Bible scholars have historically basically said Numbers 14 and Numbers 15 come from different places. They can't possibly be the same, right? They're not related to each other. And actually, they are, I think, very obviously related to each other, right? 14 ends with, is that right? Is it 14? 14 ends with mitzvah tzitzit. 15 ends with mitzvah tzitzit? Is 15 and 16 that I'm thinking of?
Yeah.
15 and 16, okay. Chapters are probably created by medieval Christians. I don't know if there's such things. The lengths you'll go to cover up for your mistakes, right? So, the end of Parsha of 15, Tzitzit, right? What is the meaning? What is said there? V'yitem kedoshim le'lo'echem. And you should become, through the observance of mitzvot, holy to the Lord your God. And come back, Parshat Korach begins. And what does Korach say to Moshe? Anybody have it in front of them?
The whole nation is holy.
Right? Everyone is holy. Rav Lachem B'nei Le'. What are you doing?
You're not more holy than anybody else. Everyone here is holy. Now, you might say, and I think Chazal are actually very perplexed by this, Korach is actually just reading Pshat Mitzvah Tzitzit, right? The Mitzvah of Tzitzit is, should all be holy. And then Korach says, Moshe, forgive me, but you just said the mitzvah is we should all be holy. So we're all holy. Get out of the way. Well, there's much more to say about that, about the mitzvah of tzitzit, which is, right, as Jacob Milgram famously, Jacob Milgram wonderfully points out, right, is about the claim that every Jew is a Kohen Gadol. The Kohen wears a tzitz that says Kodesh Lashem, right, with tchelet in it. And then B'nai Yisrael are all told you should wear a tzitzit, which in good biblical Hebrew, we can point out, is a little tzitz, in which we say, "Vitem kedoshim eloichem," with a patil tchelet. Every Jew is a Kohen Gadol. Right? Or potentially a Kohen Gadol. It's amazing. Jacob Milgram was a genius. You ever just want to spend time reading, like, a Bible scholar who, like, I always love people who, like, read the same books everyone reads and see things that no one ever sees. It's amazing. I mean, it's really kind of amazing. Now, so what does Leibovitz say? No! That is totally wrong. The mitzvah of tzitzit concludes with the mitzvah, v'yitem kedoshim eloichem. You should do the mitzvot in the aspiration to become holy. Comes Korach and says, we're all holy. Says Leibovitz, the failure to distinguish between the indicative and the imperative is the difference between religion and paganism. A religious person says there is a mitzvah to aspire to holiness, and a pagan says, you are holy. I am holy now. Now, Leibovitz, because he's Leibovitz and could never resist, then ends the Torah by saying, I'd like to take a minute to identify all the various Korachs in contemporary Israeli society. And then starts listing them. And it's like basically all of like the Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his circle, right? But his argument is there because they're making a Korachite argument. I think it's important to say they're also making an argument that has deep roots in Jewish tradition, which Leibovitz would be not deterred by at all. He would say, that's all paganism. Right? He's totally willing to say that, right? I mean, there's a person who looks at some psalms and says he's not religious. Right? You know, brazenness, lack of brazenness, or if you prefer courage, depending on if you find him sympathetic or unsympathetic, was not his shortcoming. Right? Contemporary world of the rabbinate could learn a lot if you could internalize 1 ounce of his courage. Or brazenness. Again, it depends if you think he was over the top, or courageous, or both. But the distinction there, I think, is extremely significant about everything we've been talking about. Because the Tzvi Yehuda Cook position is essentially the claim that holiness is a status. And the Leibovitz position is holiness is an aspiration that can never become a status. And the reason, I think, that animates Leibovitz, and this is where I want to sort of end up with the theology piece about the transcendent God, is that for Leibovitz, and Leibovitz's reading of the Rambam, and this is one of the points where I think he's actually right about the Rambam, if you really believe in a transcendent God who is holy, then all the things in the world are not holy. Because only God is holy. And so to assume that on some level things in this world are holy is to actually violate the truth of the utter transcendence of God. That's essentially, on some level, the Leibovitzian claim. That's his attack on Tzvi Yehuda. But again, I'm not interested in the Israeli politics piece of this. I'm interested in this sort of a contemporary manifestation of this, like, intrinsic, non-intrinsic. Or, I think where Leibovitz is even more extreme is, you actually can never be there. It's not even something that's, I think for Leibovitz, it's not something you can ever say, I've earned it by the way I've lived. It always remains, it's like, at best, an asymptote, right? It's like a journey towards the holy. So that, I think, is like a really interesting way of maybe thinking about what's at stake here, or at least, you know, our reading here of where something that has potentially ethical implications, political implications, is arguably rooted in, or at least intertwined in a very deep way with, kind of core theological commitments. You can say in a way that Maimonides is the very antithesis of the kind of sort of pantheistic claim that says, oh, well, everything is God and everything is holy. Right? It's like if you kind of construct different ways that people have of talking about sort of theology, these are as far removed as they can possibly be.
right? Spinoza's understanding of Rambam notwithstanding, right? Like, there is the utter transcendence of God means nothing in this world is holy, let alone divine. And then there's this kind of like, this thing that appears in some strands of Kabbalah, in some moods of Kabbalah, and then much more emphatically in certain liberal appropriations of Kabbalah, right? There's this like, oh, pantheism, everything is God, so everything is on some level holy, right? Now, you know, again, what happens when you draw extreme poles is that sort of like pantheistic thing looks at the Rambam and says, yeah, but effectively that's atheism, right? I mean, what was the relevance of that hyper-transcendent God? And then, you know, the Rambam looks back and says, have you heard of idolatry? Where you're basically saying everything is God? Right? Seriously? If everything is God, then nothing is God. Right? And again, I'm not trying to resolve this right now. I'm trying to sort of lay out what's at stake. Now, I put in the source sheet here, which we don't really have the time to look at, but Leibovich's inspiration for all this, I think, is, I don't know if that's exactly fair. I think a major source of inspiration is Rav Simcha Meir, a Kohen of Divinsk, known as the Meshech Chokhmah, who himself understands himself on these questions to be the heir of Maimonides, who basically says, God forbid that you should for one second contemplate the possibility that anything on earth is holy. Right? As he says, look at the fourth line, for example, Haluchot, Michtav Elohim. That is the end of the fourth line, right? The tablets of the Ten Commandments, written by God. Gam heima inam kedoshim ve'etzem rak bishvilchem. They're only holy for you. There's nothing holy about them. After all, they're not God. Let's just skip to the end. Sof davar ein shum inyan kadosh ba'ulam miyuchas lo ha'avodah v'hachniyah. There is nothing in the world that is holy which is worthy of worshipping or bowing your knee to. V'rak Hashem yitbarach shimo hu kadosh v'metziyuto ha'mechuyevet. This is really where he starts speaking like a Maimonidean. Only God in his utterly necessary existence, right, is actually holy. V'lo, and to him only, nahavati lav avodah. And to him only you should sing praise and worship. V'chol ha'kdushot him amitzad tzivui shetziva ha'borei. All the things that are holy in this world have to do with the fact that there are commandments about them. They are halachic holiness. They are, right? They are commandment holiness, but they're not intrinsic holiness. Mitzad tzivui shetzivah borei livnot mishkan lasot vazvachim v'korbanot l'shem yitbarach bilvad. Probably it's just l'shmo yitbarach bilvad. Right? Because God said, and what makes those things holy? This is crucial for him not to just read this as like a cute line. The only thing that makes them holy is that they're vehicles for serving the one thing alone that should be served. What makes holy objects holy is that they are vehicles for serving the real holy thing, which is God and God alone. So this strand of sort of Maimonidean, of sort of appropriating the Rambam, which I think is not a bad reading of the Rambam, as I said, is sort of really about, it understands its rejection of any claim of like ontology of Jewish distinction. Jews are holy in some way, in some intrinsic way, as rooted in a claim about the exclusive holiness of God. Right? It understands itself as rooted in a deeply theological commitment. It may also have deeply ethical ramifications. It may have, right, political ramifications, but it certainly, you know, is rooted in a kind of theological claim. And I guess the question maybe I want to leave people with, I hope there are many, but one of the questions I just want to make sure we draw out is, if you think of the versions of Halevi that we saw, and then, you know, quickly the sort of refraction of the Zohar in Rav Kook, the sort of soft hardware position and the hard hardware position on the one hand, and the Maimonidean sort of then played out by the Meshech Chochmah and Leibovich position, which is, let's call that the sort of software position, the refusal of intrinsic holiness. But as we saw, that comes coupled with this kind of weirdly faith-based construction of Jewish identity, at least in more philosophical sources. What would softer versions of those positions look like? Right? In other words, if we kind of draw those out as in fundamental tension with each other in deep ways, how would you construct, if you want to defend talking about a pintle yid, you know, you grew up reading Hasidic Sfarim, you can't stop talking like that, right?
But you obviously you don't want to go to where the lady goes, because you want to be more of a 21st century pluralist than that, right? And you certainly don't want to go where the Zohar goes, because oh my God, right? Right? It's very upsetting to talk that way, certainly in our time. Right? So what does that softer version look like? What's entailed in that position? And then sort of conversely, if you want to sort of embrace the Maimonidean position, nothing is holy, on its own terms, is that simply disentangleable easily and completely from the sort of notion that Jewishness, in fact, is something that comes from rationality in some way, rational achievement? It might be, it might not be. We don't have the time, I think, to sort of play that out. Are there other things you want to replace it with? Jewishness derived from a certain demeanor in the world, a certain way of worshiping it, or is that also too problematic? Because the fact is, it doesn't wrestle with halakha needing some degree of biology. That's how halakha works about Jewish identity. Can you have biology without ontology? That, I think, is actually a very profound question about thinking about how halakha thinks about Jewish identity. Can we talk about Jewish identity as being inherited biologically without making some kind of metaphysical claim about the distinction of Jews and Gentiles? I leave that as an open question. There's a lot more to say, a lot of questions, a lot of comments. Thank you all very much.